Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light. Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit. April 25th to 27th with NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. It all starts Thursday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Presented by Bud Light. Easy to drink, easy to enjoy.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan.
I'm a product of the Mississippi Delta. I was born, grew up in that environment. And the river itself dictates life all up and down it. It dictates the way you travel. It dictates the way you're going to eat. It dictates the weather patterns that come in. And the one thing that you can say about the Mississippi River as it cuts its way across our country is that it leaves marks everywhere it goes. The life of Lorenzen Wright was marked by the river. It was marked by Memphis and that place that he grew up in, that place he called home. And in July of 2010, Lorenzen was last seen alive, dealing with family, the people that he loved, the people that he took care of. It was hot. It was sticky. It was a typical Deep South summer. And nobody knew that that was going to be, on July 18th, the last time anyone would see Lorenzen Wright alive. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Jackie Howard, executive producer of Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, is joining me. Jackie, you and I both grew up in the South, and we know how temperature influences everything. We know what those sweet, sticky summers are like, hot, sultry. And Lorenzen had grown up in this environment his entire life. isn't it amazing how one man can impact so many people's lives, particularly in the town of Memphis, Tennessee?
It is, Joe. And as much as Southerners like to talk about the weather, there is nothing we like talking about more than hometown boys making it good. You know, hometown folk that go on to have great success. And that is just exactly what Lorenzen Wright did. He was a local high school basketball star in Memphis. He went on to play college basketball at the University of Memphis and then went on to play in the NBA with the Memphis Grizzlies. You can't have anyone else that's considered more of a hometown boy than Lorenzen Wright. And people described him not only as a basketball star, but as a good person. He was always giving back. He was always good with children, helping out in the community, making donations. He was well known as the person, if someone was raising money for a very noteworthy cause, Lorenzen Wright was always there to volunteer and lend a hand. Now, he was married and he had 7 children, and throughout his basketball career, he made good. But along the way, by 2010, Lorenzen Wright was 34 years old and already at the end of his NBA career. And his marriage broke down, but he was always there and considered a consummate father. But he did have one child who died as an infant from SIDS. And before we talk about what happened to Lorenzen Wright, I'd like to talk about this infant death, because we know from doing what we do how much an infant death affects the family. Tell me what SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, is and how this child died.
Yeah, it's hard to even plumb the depths of this sorrow, you know, when you have a child that passes on. You know, and it's one thing if you have a specific cause of death relative to how that child has died. But SIDS is such a broad-ranging and non-specific causal factor. And let me just kind of lay it out to you the way it works. Generally, most children that die of SIDS, they put a kind of a time frame on it. It ranges, you're looking at kids from essentially the age of about 2 to 3 months old up to about 10 months to 11 months. And, you know, just so that we understand, Lorenzen's child that did succumb to SIDS died in their 11th month of life. So they were at the outer fringes. And, you know, for years and years, people referred to SIDS is actually crib death. It's such a common thing throughout our history that people understood and have understood for years that suddenly children will just pass away and there's no explanation. And still to this day, with all of the medical technology that we have, even from a pathology standpoint, and I've worked hundreds of SIDS deaths over the years, we cannot put a specific causal factor on what brought about the death. Many times you will have mothers, and I find this consistently in my practice, you would find mothers that would state, and it was always in these terms, the mother, when you interview the mother at the emergency room or out at the home where the child has passed away, you would ask the mom, you know, like, what occurred? What has been occurring with this baby over the past, you know, couple of days, couple of weeks? Have you seen any changes in appetite or fussiness or anything like that? And they would almost consistently say, the baby had a little cold. And I don't mean cold like being chilly. I mean like slight runny nose. It was nothing too productive many times. But it seems to be tied to some kind of respiratory issue, maybe coupled with a cardiac event that we cannot put our specific fingers on. And so this death of this child, according to what we have ascertained through interviews with family and friends, they said that this impacted Lorenzen just about more than anything had in his life, because the man loved his family. He loved these kids. He loved his wife, you know. He certainly loved his parents. He spent a lot of time back home in Memphis, and, you know, his mother's from Oxford, Mississippi, which is just about 80 miles southeast of Memphis. He'd go home to visit them periodically, and family was the world to him. And to have a child that dies and dies suddenly, and then there's nothing to really intellectually hang your hat on and say this is what brought about the death, is something that you can't take a lot of comfort in.
One of the things as we move forward talking about the death of Lorenzen Wright, certainly he was affected by the death of his child, but we also find out that Lorenzen Wright was in debt tremendously. In his career with the NBA, he earned over $55 million. But as his career ended, he was basically broke. He had two homes in foreclosure. His wife, Shara, claimed that creditors were coming after them. And the thought was that this weighed upon him and the actions that he took in a very serious way.
Yeah, and you know, there had been some talk along the way that Lorenzen had been entertaining the possibility of going to Europe to play, or maybe the Middle East. I think Italy had come up and Israel had come up, you know, because they love basketball. They have their own pro leagues. And many times our players at a young age will go over and try to build up their resume and then come back to the U.S. and try to catch on with an NBA team. And this happens in the reverse as well. When, you know, the careers are winding down, some of our American players will jump over there. And isn't that, and that's something you can imagine, you know, the impact of somebody with the status of Lorenzen Wright showing up in Italy or Israel. It would put people in seats, certainly, to see him play. So there was kind of an attraction there. But, you know, we were just talking about family. Can you imagine flying literally across the world, halfway across the world? You go to Israel from, you know, Memphis, Tennessee, and you're going to be away from these kids. And I can understand why he would be so down about this, because he had worked so many years and had made it to this point in his career. He had nothing to show for it. And I'm talking about material goods. You know, people were coming after his property, these sorts of things. And he's put in this position that, look, in order to keep a roof over my head, the heads of my kids, I'm going to have to go to a foreign country to play. I can only imagine how this probably diminished him potentially as a man. And it certainly, I'm sure that it caused great anxiety in him as he moved on through the end of his career.
The state of his marriage did not help his anxiety at all. In this time, his marriage of many years dissolved, yet the couple still had a sexual, intimate relationship. So it certainly had to add to his mental confusion.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, you've still got this kind of intimacy. And look, when you have that kind of intimate physical relationship with somebody that you've been involved with, I mean, these two, you know, his ex-wife and he were both high school sweethearts. I mean, they've got a history, okay? They know each other, and they've created, you know, seven lives together as well. So they've been through good times and bad times. They've seen these great successes he's had. And yeah, I can see why that would be confusing. You know, our marriage is dissolved, but yet there's still this, you know, intimate connection. And not only the intimacy, the physical part of it, but also the intimacy when it comes to kind of these emotional strings that you have, where he's probably sharing with her the issues that are going on in his life. He might still share with her the fears that he has, the apprehension, and that sort of thing. And it really puts him in a weakened position.
And that was what many people thought of when Lorenzen Wright first went missing. Did he do something to himself, or had something happened to Lorenzen Wright?
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
To say that Lorenzen Wright was missing is kind of an odd statement when you begin to think of it. You know, Lorenzen Wright was almost 7 feet tall. How does a guy that's 7 feet tall go missing? You know, you're thinking, well, certainly with somebody with his status and his power, he would have to go missing because he chose to go missing. You know, I got to tell you, I would not want to put myself in a position where I wanted to do any harm to somebody that was 7 feet tall, that was a professional athlete, that was well-muscled. So I think that many people thought, well, he's just vanished. He's over it. He's done with the stress and those sorts of things. And that's not entirely what happened.
It's not. Lorenzen Wright was missing for 10 days. His mother absolutely knew that there was something wrong. During this time, police received a 911 call. And while no one spoke in the 911 call, all you could hear was repeated gunfire. It was not until Lorenzen Wright's body was found, again, 10 days later, that police were able to put the two pieces of this puzzle together. And all it did was open a bigger puzzle, you know, unfold more layers. How did he get to where he was found? Was he the one who was shot, or did he shoot himself? What a puzzle this is, Joe.
Yeah, it truly is. And, you know, the real tragedy in this is that when the cell phone call was made, it bounced off of a tower in what's called Germantown, Tennessee. And the 911 operator is on the line. And she made the critical error. And, you know, we talk about this a lot on Body Bags, and I certainly teach a lot about it, that, you know, you have those golden moments when you're doing a death investigation, those first 48, you know, as trite as that is, as a saying, but it's true, that's those golden 48 hours where as time begins to progress out past that marker in time, you begin to lose things, you know, physical evidence, you lose people, all these sorts of things. Jack, she waited 8 days, 8 days to make her supervisors aware of this phone call. No one even knew about it. So when investigators, and listen, this guy is, you know, you talk about local heroes, and this guy's a superstar in Memphis. I mean, he's right up there with Elvis for a lot of people in Memphis, you know. They're looking for him. Everybody's looking for him. They want to know where Lorenzen is, where he is wound up. And this, when they got that specific marker off of that cell tower, they knew that they could begin to search around in that area. And unfortunately, as a result of the search teams going out there, they found something that they didn't want to see when they arrived.
Absolutely. And that was the skeletal remains, or decomposing remains, of Lorenzen Wright. What was the state that his body was found in, Joe, knowing now, as you said earlier, hot southern day, and he had been missing for 10 days?
Yeah, it's, and look, when you're in this kind of hot, sticky environment, high humidity, high relative humidity, you know, those of us that have grown up in the deep South and that sort of thing, it's quite amazing. I would, you know, living in New Orleans for years, I'd take a shower in the morning and had to go to court. I'd put on my suit and just walking from the front door to my car, I'd be drenched in sweat. And that's the kind of environment that you're in. It's the relative humidity, not to mention the intense heat. And so, as I've talked about before, heat speeds up decomposition. And as time goes by, you have this kind of uptick in the activity of at a cellular level, which when we talk about decomposition, we talk about autolytic changes, and auto meaning self. The cells begin to, for lack of a better term, begin to kind of digest themselves, the organs and that sort of thing. And then you have these putrefaction elements that come in. Those are elements from the outside that begin to attack the body. And then you have animal activity. Now, what really speeds things up with bodies that are particularly outdoors, where you've got very hostile, hot, humid, this sort of thing, is if the individual prior to death has sustained an injury, because you have open defects in the body. Let's say you've got a stabbing, a shooting, a bludgeoning. You've got blood, a source of blood there, and you have openings. That's even going to further accelerate the activity and the decomposition. So as it turned out, you know, when they began to examine those remains, and, you know, right you were, Jackie, when you mentioned that this was not a totally skeletonized remain that they had. It was decomposing, severely decomposing. There was still some soft tissue. It's important to understand that, just to kind of frame this so that folks understand the the depth of this. This is a guy, and I read one Sports Illustrated writer that actually made this comparison. He said, this is a man that in life would go head to head with Shaquille O'Neal. And we all know how big Shaq is. We see him on television all the time. When they found his remains, Jackie, his remains totaled in weight 57 pounds. That's it. So in that period of time, in those days, his body weight had reduced from well in excess of 200 pounds all the way down to 57. And if that doesn't give you an indication as how harsh that environment is, I don't know what will.
Well, when you describe the area where he was found as harsh, that's absolutely true, because it was a very desolate area. It was very barren, which in turn meant no humans, which in turn meant lots of animal, nocturnal, predatory animal behavior.
Yeah, you do. And you experience this on multiple levels. You know, you'll even see this in the city, you know, in urban locations where you'll have animal activity. But you can imagine the population in a non-inhabited area. It's even going to be more robust with animal life. And when I say animal life, I'm talking about, you know, raccoons. wild dogs, coyotes. They're known for, you know, along the river, and we're not too far away from the Mississippi River at this location. You'll have wild hogs in this area as well. And so, yeah, they begin to compromise remains. And, you know, all of these animals, unlike us, you know, I think that we as humans, we compare ourselves to animals when, you know, we smell something bad. We just assume that animals would smell it as well. Yeah, they smell it all right, but they smell it in a different manner. They smell it with a primal sensitivity that is they're being called. They're being called by the smell in order to consume something. It's not like us. We might find it repugnant, and most of us would, and turn away from it, not wanting to put ourselves. To a certain point, our curiosity will get us. We'll smell something bad, and we'll walk upon it, discover it, and then retract from it. I've had this happen a number of times with people that found decomposing bodies, and they leave immediately. Some automatically throw up. Certainly, people are going to go call the police and that sort of thing, but animals, it's just the opposite. The more intense the smell, they're drawn in. It's almost like a magnet to steal. And that's what happens with animals. That's just the natural course of things. But to another point that I think is quite interesting, early on in the investigation, when they found Lorenzen's remains at this location where they were, it's not that far away from some businesses, like track-type businesses and track homes that had been put in that area. And one other thing, and this goes to people thinking who might have done this, there were a number of rumors that were kind of floating around at the time that they thought that given the proximity of Lorenzen's remains to the Memphis airport, they thought that maybe, just maybe, that someone had taken Lorenzen's life and then immediately left that location and hopped back on a plane and flown out of town.
In the discovery of Lorenzen Wright's body, Joe, you were talking about the animal activity, and we've talked about this before on Body Bags, that animals will disperse the bones. When the investigators started recovering the body, can you describe this a little bit for me? Because it's a little bit of a morbid fascination. When you have a decomposing remain, it's not like you can just pick the body up and move it, you know, as you would with someone who had just recently died, like if you were taking a body to the morgue. So you have a liquefied body. So, I mean, are you taking 6 inches of dirt underneath? Are you taking this by the shovel? Do you slide something underneath? How do you recover a body at that point that is so severely decomposed? And then, on top of that, you're worried about finding all of the pieces of this body that may have been dispersed by an animal.
Yeah, you know, one of the descriptors I constantly fall back to as a former investigator and a teacher now is I like to use the idea of a wagon wheel hub and the body as it is concentrically located is the hub of that event. And you start there and, you know, you raise an interesting question, and people have asked me this in the past, how do you get everything up? Because there's all kinds of tales out there about what people, you know, what happens when you try to remove severely decomposed bodies. You know, you hear stories about, you know, folks talk about, you know, how bodies are pulled apart and that sort of thing. I've even heard people say, well, bodies explode, you know, because they're filled with gas. And I've had, you know, people tell me, I had a body blow up. That doesn't happen. They leak air many times if there's still enough of the body intact. And we can go into that in greater detail another time. However, you are talking about visible skeletal remains, so you have to be very, very careful. And many times what we would do, particularly when we suspect that there's foul play, perhaps maybe a gunshot wound, is that the majority of the body, and you can kind of zero in where the body was initially, because there will be what's referred to as a grease stain on the ground. And that is, you know, you mentioned the term liquefying, as the fat of the remain begins to render down, it'll seep down into the ground beneath the body, and it leaves, the only way to really describe it, it leaves an area that almost looks as though someone has taken gasoline and poured it over that area and set that grass area on fire. It's that dark. But that's the staining from the fat liquefying. What you would do first before you ever move the body is you would run a metal detector over that area just to make sure if there is any metallic body, you're documenting it and the approximate location of it. So before you ever touch the remain itself, you would sweep the area with a metal detector, which all crime scene units essentially carry one now. It used to, they didn't. And you would pinpoint where, say, metallic objects are, like bullets or bullet casings or tips of knives or just anything. You document that before you move the body. Then, many times what we would do is you, as best you can, you try, if there's any connective tissue left and the body is still, you're still capable of rolling the body up on its side, you begin to scoot a body bag beneath the remain and then kind of roll it back into it. Once that's accomplished, you pick those remains up, place them onto a gurney, and move them away over to the side. And then you take the same metal detector and sweep over that area again. Well, one of the reasons you're doing that is you want to make sure that you're collecting any metallic bodies that may have fallen out of the body or something that was previously noted and it didn't leave with the body, okay? Then, with decomposing remains like this, you're going to treat it like an excavation before you've ever touched the body. You'll grid this area off, and you'll assign separate grid areas to, say, the area of the shoulder, if you can still appreciate where the shoulder may have been, say, the left shoulder, the right shoulder, the head, that sort of thing, and any kind of bony fragments that are there. You know, we talked about how animals play a part in this and kind of carrying away remains. One of the factors that also plays into this, where you have skeletal remains or severely decomposed remains, where great trauma has been inflicted upon a body, what will happen is that, say for instance, in the case of a skull will fragment, okay? It's not going to be totally intact. The skull is rather robust, actually, and will remain intact for a long period of time. But let's assume that a skull has been tremendously traumatized, and that large frontal bone where our forehead is has been essentially fragmented. Those little bits of fragmented bone now become dislodged and disassociated with the body, and that's one of the first things an animal is going to go after. Well, the problem with that is this. If they were shot in the forehead, for all you know, that bony prominence that the raccoon or the possum or the wild dog is walking away with might actually contain the bullet hole, the defect, that'll give us indications of things like powder and range of fire and angle of travel of the bullet and all that sort of thing. So you have to be very, very careful, not just in the immediate, at that hub of that wagon wheel I mentioned, but then kind of radiating out, you know, like the spokes on the wagon wheel, where you're going in all different directions looking for locations where animals may take things back to their burrow and hang on to them for a while. Because what they all want, what all of these animals want from bone in particular, is protein. Because it's rife with protein, and the animal can go in there and begin to chew down into the marrow and that sort of thing. And that's what the animal values in that bone.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a kind of a gross question, Joe. We have all watched the forensic television shows where an animal has eaten part of a body, and they all talk about scat. Is that something that you actually look for when you find a body?
Yes. Yeah, scat, the fecal remnant that's left behind by the animal. And I've had cases, famously, I wrote an entire chapter about a case that really impacted me in my memoir, Blood Beneath My Feet, about a lady that had been consumed by her five dogs. She'd been locked up in the house, and we had to do quite a bit of scat examination in that case because we didn't have a cause of death for her. All we knew is that we had a lady that had been locked up in the house for 4 months. She'd been locked up with her dogs, and she was deceased. And there was no soft tissue hardly left at all. So the dogs had gone into a separate area of the home, and they had left quite a bit of scat and had to go through each bit of remnant in there looking for elements of the body, bone, teeth that were consumed, of course not chewed up, but that would pass through the animal's body. So yeah, that is a real thing, and it's one of the things that we do. If you can find those locations, you know, animals, you know, they many times will not defecate near their burrow. They actually have manners. They will go to a more sequestered location off trail and, you know, pass their waste in that area, and then return back to their home. Even animals understand that, you know, about their biology, that it's not a good idea to have it near. So you have to look at kind of peripheral areas as well if you're still looking for remains. So yeah, that is a real thing, Jackie.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity, and it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
As a medical legal death investigator, you know, intact remains, I think it goes without saying, are it's so much better to work with those as opposed to skeletal remains, because, you know, our indications for things that we're looking for, like trauma, body's response to trauma, all those sorts of things, is many times tied up in soft tissue, the soft tissue remain, you know, and it gives us an indication of what kind of trauma the person sustained in life, in their antemortem state or even their perimortem state where they're kind of headed toward death. In Lorenzen Wright's case, there was very little soft tissue that was left behind. The investigators in his case became heavily reliant upon the examination of skeletal remains.
You were talking about using a metal detector over the scene to find any metal particles that needed to be picked up. So I'm wondering, given the state of Lorenzen Wright's body when it was discovered, would they have immediately been able to tell that he had been shot 5 times?
Well, yeah, you can. And actually, you can appreciate it at the scene to a certain degree. You know, if you go back to, say, for instance, the skull, it's pretty easy to get an idea if the skull has been traumatized because it's so glaring. The what we refer to as the external table of the skull, which is essentially the external surface of the skull, can greatly be appreciated even at the scene. And I think that they did appreciate that then. But they knew that it would require further examination. And just to kind of give you an example, when they finally did get Lorenzen's remains back to the morgue, an examination was conducted of the skull, and they determined right then, and probably the way they did this is that they took the skull individually and x-rayed it, and it's because of that that they found a bullet jacket within the skull, and the jacket is kind of this copper outer shell that will encase the lead core of the bullet, kind of holds it together, and many times this copper jacketing will peel back off of the bullet and it's left behind. You might have the actual projectile that'll pass on through the skull, but that copper jacket will be left behind, and you'll find many times, sometimes it'll be completely intact, and that goes to the type of ammunition, you know, that you're looking at in any particular case. The jackets are very important because they will have rifling marks on them so that we can do ballistic studies. And in his case, they did in fact find a bullet jacket in his skull. And also there were, in some of the decomposed soft tissue of the chest, they found two projectiles in there. The thing about it is you've got multiple gunshot wounds that Lorenzen had sustained in life and that brought about his death. And I think one of the biggest questions you talked just a second ago about the issue with the metal detector. One of the things that kind of haunts you as an investigator, you know, you're scratching your head over it and you're thinking, did I get everything? And you don't want to release the scene too early in a case like this in case you miss something. I've been back out and we do what are called retro scene visits. I've been out to scenes where homicides had taken place and there was a partial excavation at that moment in time. You still think I'm missing something, and you'll go back out, maybe you and one of your colleagues or maybe a team of colleagues, and you'll sweep the area again. And it's amazing what you can find when you go back out, because, you know, you get distracted sometimes when there is a body there because everybody's focused on the body. And interestingly enough, it's important to look at the periphery. And one little anecdotal thing that has always stuck with me my entire life, I read a book many years ago by Dr. Tom Noguchi, and he was the chief medical examiner coroner for LA. And Dr. Noguchi, who's one of my forensic heroes, he stated he was actually physically at the scene at the Sharon Tate homicide. One of the things that Dr. Noguchi had brought forward in his writing, he said, I learned at an early age as a death investigator to not focus on the body when I initially arrive at the scene. And that seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? What Dr. Noguchi said that he would do if he was in a room is he would look at the ceiling, he would look at the walls, he would look at the surrounding area, the furniture, anything. He would avert his eyes from the body as long as he possibly could. And what this did, this practice that he did, it really centered himself in this environment so that the body was not the most important item that was there. He's looking for other peripheral issues before he gets distracted by the body. And that's really tough to learn as a young death investigator, but it's certainly something you need to learn.
I'm wondering, Joe, in finding a body that has been shot, obviously suicide is a consideration that has to be made. However, the likelihood that someone shot themselves five times is unlikely, depending on where they were shot. But I'm wondering if when you have a decomposed body like this, the hands are not intact, so you're not looking for GSR, for gunshot residue on the hands, but is there forensic testing done looking for gunshot residue?
Oh, yeah. And in the beauty, if we can say that term, I hate that that term associated with Lorenzen's case, but it actually helped, is the fact that his clothing was still there, Jackie. When they did the examination of his body, they were able to take each piece of clothing and examine it thoroughly. And just in that initial examination, they could appreciate that there were defects in the shirt where they could see that a round had possibly passed through there, not just one, but several. And so, you know, when you think about, I'll tell you, you know, because we talk about this a lot on Nancy's show, you know, we talk about range of fire, don't we? You know, and she loves to go into the descriptor of using the water hose and the disbursement of powder and all that. And it's a beautiful description. But when you look at a piece of clothing as opposed to having skin, the clothing many times will be more resilient. In this case, it was. And it was a great indicator as to either presence or absence of a remnant that's left behind by a gun being fired. And is there anything there to give us an indication as to range of fire? Because, you know, once you move out, these numbers vary. They're not necessarily static. But many people will say if you're out any further than 18 to 36 inches away from the body, a lot of this is going to be caliber dependent, the load dependent, and just relationship-wise, physical relationship-wise, you're not going to see anything. The closer in you get, you're going to have this stamping that kind of takes place with all this debris that blows out of the end of that muzzle. You know, the bullet is very important. The projectile, I hate using the term bullet, but the projectile itself, that thing that's going downrange, that's going to end somebody's life. But also, people don't understand, there's all kinds of debris that comes out of the end of the barrel. You know, you've got fire from this tiny explosion that's going on. You've got smoke that comes out, and that can deposit. You've got grease, and people say, grease? Yeah, you can have grease stains. And that comes because when projectiles are put together, they're crimped. So you've got the lead projectile that goes into the casing, and it's actually crimped. And what they will do is they'll smear a little bit of grease along the inner rim of that casing, and that ensures that this thing is lubricated. It's going to exit. Okay, so you'll get grease many times, and then you'll get unburned powder. And some people will refer to this in different terms. You'll have stippling, you'll have tattooing, all these sorts of things. So you've got all of these myriad of factors that play in. So if you have clothing that's available, even in spite of the fact that you've got this decompositional event going on, the clothing's going to help you. It's going to give you an idea of what may have happened.
So obviously, at this point, the investigation turns to who could have killed Lorenzen Wright. Ultimately, Lorenzen Wright's wife, Shira, and Billy Turner, someone known to both of the Wrights, and Jimmy Martin are charged in connection with Lorenzen's death. But here's the problem, or the issue. The weapon used to kill Lorenzen Wright was not found for 7 years, Joe. And when it was found, it had been underwater for 7 years. What do you do?
You have to treat it very carefully, dependent upon, you know, look, if you've got a weapon that has been deposited, say, for instance, in salt water or even brackish water, good luck, because it's going to be very, very difficult to get any kind of ballistic evidence out of that, because saltwater environments are so very harsh. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a freshwater pond. So dependent upon the skill level and the condition of the weapon that's brought into the firearms examination unit, which, you know, in this case would have been up there in Tennessee where this was perpetrated, the question is, are you able to get a specific forensic tie back to that weapon? Is it so compromised? Because the weapon is going to rust. It's going to break down. It's sitting down there probably, you know, I don't know of any single pond in Mississippi and, you know, that area of Tennessee and over in Arkansas and Louisiana, all that area adjacent to the Mississippi River that doesn't have a bottom. It's just mud. And so it's not the best environment to preserve a weapon in. So, yeah, it can be greatly compromised. And, you know, beyond that, beyond like a ballistic signature, if you will, one of the most important things also is to try to recover a serial number off of that weapon. And, you know, the technology has advanced so far now that, you know, it would be, I'm not going to say it's an easy task, but it's much easier than it used to be able to pull that number off of a weapon. And people think, well, I don't know what people necessarily think, but I think that there's this kind of idea that you have one serial number on a weapon, All right. And that's not the case. You'll have serial numbers that are stamped in various locations dependent upon the manufacturer of that weapon throughout the weapon. And can you recover it? And if you can recover that serial number, then you can begin to pair that up with individuals. Certainly you can pair it up to where that weapon left what factory and at what date, and then maybe where it was sent to be sold, you know, and then potentially who it was sold to. And so that's also a big issue that you're looking for, because, you know, at the end of the day, the weapon is very specific. It's specific to an individual. It has, you know, and back to forensics specifically, we have a construct within forensics that's called individualization. And that is that an item, whether it be a spoon, a steak knife, or, you know, a semi-automatic pistol, it has individual characteristics that can be tied back to that item and to whatever trauma it might have inflicted upon somebody. And it makes it unique. Even if, say, for instance, in the example of a firearm, even if it's made in some great big batch of similar weapons or exact weapons from a manufacturer, each one of those weapons that rolls off the line is going to be unique even before it's fired. And then you begin to think about things like, how was it cared for? How many times were rounds pushed through it? Did you use cheap ammunition with it? Did you use expensive ammunition? Did you know what you were doing when you took the weapon apart to clean it? So those, each marker along that continuum is a point of individualization that makes that weapon quite unique. But it's important to have recovered it, and they would not have recovered it had, I think it's Shira's cousin, Jimmy, he stated that, you know, he helped dispose of this weapon. They deposited that weapon out in that pond.
You were talking about specifics, Joe, and one of the things that we talk about all the time are the gun striations that come from the barrel of the gun that show up on the bullet when it's been fired. So when you have a weapon that's been underwater like this and you brought up the rusting, do you get to a point, or can you get that barrel back to a point where you can match striations? I mean, can you, you know, insert something down to it to say, oh, look, there's the striation, you know, the mark that we see on this bullet? Or is it at that point, is all of that information just lost?
I'll put it to you this way. Ballistics people are some of the most fascinating individuals within the forensic science community. And the reason they're fascinating is that they still work on an old, almost a medieval principle when they're training. They actually become apprentices. It doesn't matter how much education you have, formal education, like a master's degree in forensic science. It doesn't matter. If you're going to be a ballistics examiner, you're going to start off as an apprentice. You would not want to turn this job over to an apprentice. This would have to be a master firearms examiner that would be able to go in, because this is the problem that you run up against. If you're trying to clean the weapon to the point where you can examine it, because it's not just like this thing's going to be cleaned and restored and go up on your shelf, or you're going to display it to friends, or you can go out and use it. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a scientific examination of this thing, so that if I match it up with the bullet or with the projectile, will it stand up in court? Because I can tell you, any defense attorney worth their salt is going to stand up and say, well, what procedures did you go through to clean this weapon or to get the weapon back to where it's still functional? And how was that conducted? What did you do in order to assure that you didn't compromise the structural integrity of this weapon when you're trying to remove all the oxidation and everything off of it? And it's a very, very fine line. You really have to know what you're doing. And this can't be your first time out of the gate if you're going to do this. You have to have done this multiple times and done it under the supervision of a journeyman or a master before you get it to the point where it's going to be acceptable in court.
Ultimately, Shira Wright pleads guilty to two charges. She takes a plea deal: facilitation of first-degree murder and facilitation of attempted first-degree murder. And she was considered the mastermind of this murder. She is still currently in jail.
Hey, Jackie, that's not all. And, you know, we have to consider, you know, this the pain that this family, that Lorenzen's family and friends and all the folks from Memphis have gone through over all of these years. I think that finally the door has been closed on this case, because as of July the 8th, I think Billy Ray Turner was finally sentenced on a Friday to life in prison plus 25 additional years for killing Lorenzen. You know, he had a hand in this and brought about the death of Lorenzen after he had entered into a conspiracy with Lorenzen's ex-wife, Shara. So now he's going to be serving out the rest of his life in jail. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light. Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit. April 25th to 27th with NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon. And on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. It all starts Thursday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Rocket Mortgage, official partner of the NFL Draft.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.